You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Yeah, you are. So, good Tuesday morning to you. Mike McMurrin for a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Completing our 52nd week. That's right. Next week. Boom. We're no longer one pump chumps. That's right. Getting ready for our second. How about that? Who thought that would happen when we started? I did. That's right. I did. So anyway, good morning to you. Hope you had a good weekend. I did. I cleaned a lot. Did a lot of yard work. For whatever reason, cleaning and yard work liberates me. Yeah, it sets me free from the tyranny of whatever, my existence. I'll tell you what we're going to do in a second today, and then we got some stuff to talk about. I don't know what we do about Memorial Day, but I think a lot of, I would consider myself in the company of a lot of people in terms of the way they go about Memorial Day, which is they kind of insulate themselves a little bit from it. And the reason they do that is some of the stuff that goes on is just, it's just a little bit, I don't know, frustrating, hurts your feelings a little bit, frustrates you. It's like, come on, man, do you not know? Do you not know better than that? You know, where have you been for the last 50 years of your life, for the last 30 years of your life, for the last 20 years of your life? Where in the hell have you been? So I think a lot of people, I mean, what do? You just, I think you go off by yourself. You go off by yourself. And, you know, you do yard work, which I did. I had one flower bed. I had one flower bed on left to weed, so I did that. And then I had some other cleaning I had to do, so I did that. And, so did some yard work. Did some cleaning, and now I'm rounds complete. I'm like cleaning complete, yard complete, everything's where it needs to be. I'm pretty happy. I'm pretty fired up about that. That's right. So anyway, so I did that. I also watched a few things over the weekend. I finished watching Pacific. It's the first time I ever watched it by myself. Kind of how would I say that? You know, kind of like where you stop it, rewind it, things like that. Notice smaller things. And I will tell you, it's to me, Pacific is so different than Band of Brothers. Pacific is so dark in its subject matter. And both of them, I think, if you've ever gone to war for your country, one of the things they both just absolutely slay is the mental things that people go through. And I think at the end of Pacific, you know, you see their World War II era intimacy of they've survived this thing that they never thought they'd survive. You also see during the fighting on Okinawa, which was long and crazy. And, you know, there's a reason why, you know, Sledge survived. He's a mortarman, man. And that had its benefits. You weren't up there with the rest of the rifle platoons. You were in weapons platoon, and normally you were, you know, an echelon behind. And then they get a chance on Okinawa, they get yanked up. And you can see the dread on their face when they go forward as riflemen and what they deal with, how the civilians got intermingled with the Japanese and the Japanese used them and just awful stuff. But then, you know, as they kind of, you know, make their way home and you see different scenes. It's pretty pointed stuff. So, anyway, I watched that over the weekend. I had the chance, and we'll talk about it here in a little bit, I had a chance to let me read you an email. Mac, please tell me you're going to talk about Happy Memorial Day. What can you say? You know, it's probably, you hear it and you just cringe. You're like, come on, think about it. You know? And I, let me tell you, I heard it on baseball games. Just like, oh my God. Stop it. Happy Memorial Day, everybody. Like, and again, the thought that goes through my head is the biblical thought, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. In that, they're ignorant, so what do you do to make them more aware? So I've got a letter typed up to Major League Baseball about just a memo to send out. Please tell your broadcasters not to say Happy Memorial Day. You know, welcome on Memorial Day to blah, 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 blah. But, and again, somebody no less than Joe Buck, right? He's at the top of the heap. And he's ignorant. Happy Memorial Day, everybody. Yeah, Joe, can't wait to grill or go to the mattress sale. It's awesome. Really? So, no, we'll get to that here. Etiquette. What can you do? So, we'll get to Happy Memorial Day here in a little bit. And then, what else? And then I had some people come over. They wanted to see Colleen, my daughter. And, so we grilled, you know, yesterday and had dinner and had a nice day as I watched the Yankees lose to Baltimore, which didn't make me happy, but anyway. So, that was my weekend. Let me tell you what we're going to do today. You know, I'll tell you the other thing that was going on over the weekend that since you all listen, that you'll be familiar with is, Richard Caruso, who you've heard on this program before. Hold on. Mac, what about the baseball fight between the Giants and the Nationals? Yeah, that was a good one. I think fighting is a good thing, and I don't think fighting is a bad thing in sports. I think they should let them fight. But a couple notes about the fight itself. So this goes back a couple years when Bryce Harper, who's one of the best players in Major League Baseball, Bryce Harper hits a couple home runs off the guy who's pitching in San Francisco. And I don't even know that dude's name, but he can throw really hard. And so first pitch, the guy's name is Hunter Strickland. He hits him right in the hip. And normally what happens in a baseball fight is if, you know, the catcher's no dope. He knows what's going to happen. And so the catcher will jump up and grab the guy and not let him get to the pitcher, right? The Giants catcher is a guy named Buster Posey. And he's kind of a girly boy when it comes to this physical contact stuff. I saw him do this 2 years ago, and my cousin and his son are huge Giant fans. And I said, hey, look, let me just tell you straight up. That guy, he's not a man in my book. He didn't even, like, do anything to help. And he did the same thing yesterday. So the Strickland throws at Harper, hits him right in the hip. Harper looks out at him. At that point, Posey should get between him. Posey doesn't move. So Harper takes off to the mound. Posey never moves. He just stands there and lets it happen, which is samurai violation. I don't know how he walks. Like, he walks. He can hit. That's about it. So anyway, the guy who is awesome in this fight is a guy who played at Notre Dame. He was a wide receiver, and then he's a pitcher on Notre Dame's baseball team, and now he's a pitcher in the big leagues. His name's Jeff Samardzija. he comes flying off the giant bench. And Samard says, I want to say he's like 6'6". He's a big guy. He's wide receiver. And he comes flying into this pile trying to get at Harper. And it was awesome. But I think they ought to let guys fight in sports, kind of like hockey. You know, no harm, no foul. You can fight. Settle this stuff. Get it out of your system. Although, here's what I would do in baseball. Third man in is suspended for a month without pay. Yeah. So you better really want to get in this fight because you'll be suspended. Maybe make it in 3 months. You'll be suspended. So that way you'd have like a hockey fight going on. The only people who can get involved are the umpires. So what would that do to fighting? I guess if you weren't a good fighter and you were a pitcher, you're probably not going to throw at guys because you know nobody can help you. Yeah, you're going to have to stand there in front of 50,000 people and slug it out and have everybody watch it on national TV. And if you're a hitter, you know, you would probably be careful about who you're glaring at and what you're doing because, you know, you're not a good fighter. So I think that would solve it. Don't just let them fight. Let them fight. And so these guys threw blows. It was all right. Anyway, Memorial Day weekend. Yeah, wall-to-wall baseball. Yeah, it was baseball's marquee game on yesterday. I think it was on it came on at about noon Pacific, so 3 Eastern time. So Stanley Cup playoffs are going. But anyway, let me tell you what we're going to do on All Marine Radio today. You're going to hear in about, let's see, we'll take a few headlines. And then you'll hear from, General Mattis was on Face the Nation on Sunday. He was up at West Point as obviously the guest of honor. And he is a bit of a rock star wherever he goes. If you watch the way he gets treated, people know of him. They know him as a warrior. And it has a magical effect wherever he goes. And if you've ever been around him, I mean, and he was that way even with, you know, there's a lot of generals that show up at different things. But there's some that have a certain charisma about them. And I would call it a combat charisma about them. And Secretary Mattis is one of those guys. When he rolled into some place, Marines were excited to hear what he had to say. So you'll hear him today. And you'll hear the entire interview, which is I think, what you want to hear. And what you really want to hear is the end of it. And he gets asked, what keeps you awake at night? And he says, nothing. I keep other people awake. But he just says it. He deadpans it. It's awesome. And he believes it. Yeah, obviously, he believes it. So anyway, there's some stuff in the news that we should talk about, so we'll do that. And then General Kelly, former Marine, obviously, and Secretary of Homeland Security. He was interviewed on this week on ABC. So we'll play his interview. Mattis interview about 30 minutes. Kelly interview about 8. And then we'll check the news headlines, and then it'll be time for the gunner to join us. So we'll hear from Mike, see what Mike did over the weekend. So a very good Tuesday morning to you. Almost the start of June. The summer officially began over the course of the weekend. So hold on, one more email. Mac, I swear to God, I thought my head was going to explode if I heard Happy Memorial Day one more time. What can we do? It's got to be a social media thing. Hashtag stop saying Happy Memorial Day. Maybe something as simple as that. And so hopefully somebody in the family sees it on Twitter. And then they educate other members of the family. That's all we need is just a little bit of education. Ohio man, what impressed me with the first exchange of punches? they wanted to fight. as baseball fights usually are just this side of a good dry hump. There should be a mandatory suspension long for any player that leaves the bench or the bullpen. Nothing will equal a Nolan Ryan teaching Robin Ventura a lesson. If you missed that, Nolan Ryan was about 40. I swear to God, he was like 45 years old, probably around 40 at the time. Robin Ventura's a young kid. Ryan hits him. And Robin Ventura, you know, he charges him out. Nolan Ryan gets him in a headlock, and he punches him in the head. I don't know how many times. Yeah, the moral of the story is don't charge them out if you can't fight because nobody's coming to rescue you because it's a long suspension. It's 93, 4 months. And so then what you would do is you would install fighting in baseball, right? If you fight, you're going to get kicked out of the game, okay? You know, it's a legitimate way to solve an issue. We accept that. Because all they do when they warn everybody is they just postpone it to another game. That's not going away. Those guys know. And what's funny is having a father who was in Major League Baseball, you know, he would say, you know, people don't know when you're watching the game or when you're in the stands. You don't know. He said, but we do. And he said, look, you'll know. For instance, there probably wasn't a pitcher or position player on the Giants that didn't know what was going to happen when Bryce Harper came up. And there's no coincidence that another pitcher, Jeff Samardzija, got out there quick. Because they knew. Because they talked about it. And that's when you see, like, everybody on the top rail of the bench, like, very early in the game. Like, whoa, why is it standing room only? Because they know what's going on. So, but if we throw in the third man rule into the fight and suspend everybody that does that, then it is what it is. Then you're going to stand out there in front of 50,000 people and duke it out. Yeah, it's awesome. It would be awesome. Yeah, so I'm a huge fan of it. Like fighting in hockey, it's not a bad thing. You know, guys settle grudges, they're not using their sticks, they're not running guys into the boards and stuff like that. It's a healthy outlet. So I think the same thing in the NBA. No third man in. Let's go. Let's see some fighting. Anyway, but it wasn't a, yeah, they connected a few times, so it was good. All right, we're going to get this thing going. The United States Marine Corps Band makes it official today. Good morning to you. The last phase of the operation in Mosul is underway around the old city. We'll talk about that. Secretary Mattis talks about that as well. So, good morning to you.
Our flag is on the road to victory. So, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
As long as it's politically feasible. Okay, that's the caveat that goes with that. So, lived in a different planet. Actually, you know, he lived in our planet for a while. Yeah. You know, what's interesting that just kind of popped into my head is John Kennedy PT-109 and all that stuff, right? What medals did he wear because of that? So he's a, it says here, he was a lieutenant. Okay, so captain equivalent in the Marine Corps. So what award did he receive? That's what I'm looking for. He received, on June 12, 1944, while he was in the hospital recuperating from back surgery, Kennedy received the Navy and Marine Corps Medal for courage, endurance, and excellent leadership that contributed to saving several lives and was in highest keeping. Yeah, that's not so much, I guess, maybe. That's all. I don't know. The thing that popped into my head was the Navy didn't kind of go very far out of their way for Lieutenant Kennedy when that happened. I mean, there were certainly other awards they could have given him, I think. Maybe not. You couldn't. That didn't rate a Bronze Star? Action against the enemy? I don't know. I know it's the appropriate, certainly the appropriate award in peacetime, but in combat, it just struck my head. I don't remember him wearing, you know, a Bronze Star or something like that, a Silver Star or anything like that, or actions that night. Anyway, the weather around the Marine Corps, 66 and cloudy in Quantico, Big Timber, Montana, home of Montana Man, 56 degrees and sunny, Camp Lejeune. I gotta unscrew my geography here. Big Timber's out of sequence. I try to go East Coast, center of the country, blah, 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 blah. Camp Lejeune, partly sunny in 78. They've got a couple different weather events going on out there. Grand Prairie, Texas, 74 degrees and partly sunny. 29 Palms, partly sunny. And 73 Pendleton, overcast in 60. Camp Smith in Hawaii, close your eyes and say it, 74 and dark. That's right, and cloudy. In Okinawa, Japan, 76 and dark and cloudy. They are 8 hours behind here, so 11:30 at night. 23:30 for all your military dorks. Camps, Fallujah, 105, as they get ready for summer. At the home of Almarin Radio, 60 degrees overcast. Looking for a high of only 69 degrees here. That is a look at the weather when we come back. You're going to hear Secretary Mattis as he appeared on Face the Nation. Interesting comments, especially the stuff he says at the end when they ask him what keeps you awake at night. But the whole thing, obviously, I mean, the thing about General Mattis that you love is, especially in this capacity, there's two things I'll tell you about the interview that I found interesting. One, he's always spot on, and he's always very precise with his words, and he explains what annihilation means, which is kind of cool. And then he makes a point about the nation and the lack of coming together, that we can debate all we want, but the difference that he sees in the nation now is we don't come together to solve the problem after the debate. We turn our backs, and that's why things like sequestration happen, because you can't pass a budget. What the hell good are they if they don't pass a budget? Answer, they're not. What's their job? Pass a budget? Yes, I think so. So he makes that point, and in a very articulate way. So it's I find it kind of interesting that we see a cabinet secretary, probably the most prominent one in stature in terms of respect, that he and he gets it when he shows up and he starts taking questions. You can see the respect people have for him for being, because they dealt with him for years and they know he's a straight shooter. And he'll tell it to you unvarnished, too. But when a guy like that begins to call out the system, I think that's an awesome thing. And I will tell you that General Kelly has variations of that he's talked about. And I think it's a good sign when you have people that high in government that are pointing out the dysfunctional nature of the way our government currently performs. That, you know what, you can get pissed and you can scream and yell about the Trump health care proposal. But the bottom line is this: Obamacare is collapsing under its own weight. It ought to be fixed for the greater good of the nation. And the people that we elect who take an oath to support and defend the Constitution ought to get after making it better. So I think you'll find that interesting. So we'll take a break. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug. Don't touch that dial. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world famous Battle Mug. Starts with 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com. All you Mustangs, listen up. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is comprised of Marine Corps officers and officers from other military services who share a common background. They are a group of men and women who initially enlisted and served with distinction in the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps Reserve Enlisted rank. The term Mustang refers to a commissioned or warrant officer who has risen from the enlisted ranks. The Marine Corps Mustang Association was founded by Captain Robert Richter, United States Marine Corps retired, in Philadelphia on 10 November 1985 as a nonprofit veteran service organization. In their 33rd year of existence, the association continues to dedicate itself to the advocacy of professional development and the encouragement of younger Marines, demonstrating a pathway for advancement and offering mentoring, advice, and camaraderie over the course of their military service and civilian careers. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is looking for a few good Mustangs to join their association. Contact them via their website, MarineCorpsMustang.org. I say again, MarineCorpsMustang.org. Find them on Facebook, go ahead and like them. Most importantly, join their association so that they can continue to do the great work that they've done for the past 33 years.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. I was yelling at my daughter, so with apology. I wasn't yelling at her per se. I was just guiding her. She can't swallow a pill. Exactly. Okay, put the pill in your mouth. Now fill your mouth full of liquid and swallow the liquid. What? God, are you kidding me? How do you get through the day? You know, one of the things I do love about watching, you might hear General Mattis' speech yesterday, too, at Arlington. But one of the things I love about seeing Mattis and Kelly and Dunford together is the familiarity you see. And you see them when they're all together, you see them, they laugh on camera a fair amount. And because of their familiarity. So it's very cool if you've ever served with them or just the fact that they're Marines and again, how their careers crossed paths and then ultimately the work they did together and now they're still doing the same kind of work. But anyway. All right, so the Secretary of Defense was up at West Point over the weekend and he did an interview with Face the Nation. So you're going to hear that right now. Let me just make sure I have all the buttons pushed. So when I say go, this thing actually does work. All right, and it's a good interview, like all his interviews are. It runs about 30 minutes in length. So shut your door, tell your coworkers not to bother. Tell your coworkers not to bother you that you're going to be in the cone of silence here a little bit, and here. The Secretary of Defense. So here he is, in his own words, James Mattis.
Mr. Secretary, ISIS took credit for the bombing in Manchester, England. Update us on the strategy to defeat ISIS.
Well, what you saw in Manchester was emblematic of what this transnational threat is capable of doing. Recognizing that reality, we have somewhere around 65 nations, 67 nations. It's growing as we speak. Plus, we've got Interpol, the Arab League, the European Union, and as of 2 days ago, when President Trump was in Brussels, the Secretary Tillerson, NATO has joined the coalition as well as NATO organization. Our strategy right now is to accelerate the campaign against ISIS. it is a threat to all civilized nations. And you saw that statement being given by President Trump in Riyadh. You've heard it out of Brussels. This is the understanding that Prime Minister May gave to the world about what had hit England. And the bottom line is we are going to move in an accelerated and reinforced manner, throw them on their back foot. We are going to shift from, we have already shifted from attrition tactics where we shove them from one position to another in Iraq and Syria to annihilation tactics where we surround them. Our intention is that the foreign fighters do not survive the fight to return home to North Africa, to Europe, to America, to Asia, to Africa. We're not going to allow them to do so. We're going to stop them there and take apart the caliphate.
Explain for people who don't understand that what it means to be moving in an annihilation posture as opposed to attrition.
Well, attrition is where you keep pushing them out of the areas that they're in, John. And what we intend to do by surrounding them is to not allow them to fall back, thus reinforcing themselves as they get smaller and smaller, making the fight tougher and tougher. We're going to isolate those objectives, and you see that right now, for example, in western Mosul that is surrounded, and the Iraqi security forces are moving against them. Tal Afar is now surrounded. We have got efforts underway right now to surround their self-declared caliphate capital of Raqqa. That surrounding operation is going on, and once surrounded, then we'll go in and clean them out.
What does it mean on the ground, though? Does it mean just more raids, more from the air? What does it mean in practical terms that's changed as we get this acceleration?
Okay, in practical terms, with acceleration, we do have more advisors in locations where they can call for NATO airstrikes. We have got more intelligent stare going on as we stare at this enemy and find their vulnerabilities. And then we have the forces to move against them, principally by, with, and through our allies.
One of the things you've mentioned in this new accelerated tempo is that the president has delegated authority to the right level. What does that mean?
When you're in operations, the best thing you can do at the top level is get the strategy right. You have to get the big ideas right. You have to determine what is the policy, what is the level of effort you're willing to commit to it, and then you delegate to those who have to execute that strategy to the appropriate level. What's the appropriate level? It's the level where people are trained and equipped to take decisions so we move swiftly against the enemy. There is no corporation in the world that would, in a competitive environment, try and concentrate all decisions at the corporate level. You don't do that because in a competitive environment, you've got to move swiftly in order to take the lead. In this case, we delegate to the appropriate level, but I would point out here that we have not changed the rules of engagement. There is no relaxation of our attention to protect the innocent, even while we work with an enemy who intentionally will not allow civilians to pull out of areas they're fighting in, who intentionally endangers them, has used civilians as human shields. We do everything we can to protect the civilians, and actually lowering, delegating the authority to the lower level allows us to do this better.
Does that mean at the lower level where these decisions are now being made, people have more freedom to move, less chance they're going to get second-guessed? Is that what it means in practical terms?
It means they can use their initiative, John. They can use their initiative and maintain the integrity of the fight, the managerial integrity of the fight, thus reducing the danger to innocent people caught up on a battlefield. Unlike ISIS, we believe the battlefield is also a humanitarian field. Look at what the Iraqis are doing, getting relief supplies set up so they are ready for the refugees who are going to be forced out of these areas as the fighting continues. We have got to recognize we cannot leave these areas under ISIS control. If you leave them under ISIS control, from Ankara to Brussels, from Paris to Manchester, we'll continue to see them using this haven to export violence. We have got to go after them, and at the same time, we have to protect the civilians who are caught up on these humanitarian fields.
So in that case, do you mean after the annihilation has been done, does that mean you can't let it fall back into ISIS hands, that it has to be held essentially in some way?
Once ISIS is defeated, there's a larger effort underway to make certain that we don't just sprout a new enemy. For example, Secretary Tillerson, about 2 months ago, ran a meeting at the U.S. Department of State where 60-odd nations, plus Interpol and the Arab League and others, joined him. And the whole, I would say, conference, at least 85% of it, is what about the next step? We know ISIS is going to go down. We've had success on the battlefield. We've freed millions of people from being under their control. And not one inch of that ground that ISIS has lost has ISIS regained. It shows the effectiveness of what we're doing. However, there are larger currents, there are larger confrontations in this part of the world, and we cannot be blind to those. That is why they met in Washington under Secretary Tillerson's effort to carry out President Trump's strategy to make certain we don't just clean out this enemy and end up with a new enemy in the same area.
How does this new accelerated tempo feel, in your estimation, from those who are now getting to make the decisions at the appropriate level? Has it changed in terms of the operational tempo or the climate for those who are now getting to make decisions to move to use that initiative you talked about?
Our allies have been very positive in their assessments of what has changed.
You served under President Obama. You're now serving President Trump. How are they different?
Everyone leads in their own way, John. Everyone leads in their own manner. In the case of the President of the United States, in the case of the President, he has got to select the right people that he has trust in to carry out his vision of a strategy. And I would just tell you that right now, that with Secretary Tillerson and I, we try to have breakfast at least once a week. We are on the phone 4 or 5 times a week together. We coordinate all of the president's campaign. We just make certain that foreign policy is led by the State Department. I inform Secretary Tillerson of the military factors, and we make certain that then when we come out of our meetings, State Department and Defense Department are tied tightly together, and we can give straightforward advice to the commander-in-chief.
President Trump has said to defeat ISIS, he has said there has to be a humiliation of ISIS. What does that mean?
I think as we look at this problem of ISIS, it's more than just an army. It's more than just a fight that we have on our hands in terms of military forces, law enforcement. It's also a fight about ideas. And we have got to dry up their recruiting. We have got to dry up their fundraising. The way we intend to do it is to humiliate them, to divorce them from any nation giving them protection, and humiliating their message of hatred, of violence. Anyone who kills women and children is not devout. They cannot dress themselves up in false religious garb and say that somehow this message has dignity, this message has continuity. We're going to strip them of any dignity. We're going to strip them of any kind of legitimacy, and that is why you see the international community acting in concert. And as the Americans provide more forceful leadership, more aggressive leadership, accelerated leadership in this campaign, you see more nations signing up.
This aggressive leadership, this aggressive tempo, when should Americans look to see victory?
This is going to be a long fight. The problems that we confront are going to lead to an era of frequent skirmishing. We will do it by, with, and through other nations. We will do it through developing their capabilities to do a lot of the fighting. We'll help them with intelligence. Certainly we can help train them for what they face. And you see our forces engaged in that, from Africa to Asia. But at the same time, this is going to be a long fight, and I don't put timelines on fights.
The fight is more aggressive. That means more casualties, doesn't it?
It doesn't have to mean more casualties. At times it means the enemy may suffer more casualties. It's not an automatic that we will. There is, obviously, to our young troops going into harm's way, they know what they're getting into. They're the best trained in the world. They're superbly equipped. And right now I would just tell you that the enemy, we intend to make the enemy pay the price. We're going to do everything we can to keep our allies and our troops alive.
What about civilian casualties as a result of this faster tempo?
Civilian casualties are a fact of life in this sort of situation. We do everything humanly possible, unlike our enemy, unlike our adversary, whether it be Lebanese Hezbollah and the way they fought against the Israelis, we've seen that, or you look at ISIS and their fight against the international community. No matter where you find these terrorists, Al-Qaeda, they have a callous disregard for human life, for civilian life. We, on the other hand, do everything humanly possible, consistent with military necessity, taking many chances to avoid civilian casualties at all costs.
Under this new aggressive posture, what can be done that could not have been done or would not have been done, say, 6 months ago?
Probably the most important thing we are doing now is we are accelerating this fight. We are accelerating the tempo of it. We are going to squash the enemy's ability to give some indication that they have invulnerability, that they can exist, that they can send people off to Istanbul, to Belgium, to Great Britain and kill people with impunity. We're going to shatter their sense of invincibility. They're in the physical caliphate. That's only one phase of this. Then we have the virtual caliphate that they use the internet. Obviously, we're going to have to watch for other organizations growing up. But the bottom line is we're going to continue to press against them, and that's got to be the method that we use right now. We cannot go into some kind of complacency. I'm from the American West. We have forest fires out there, and some of the worst forest fires in our history, the most damage were caused when we pulled the fire crews off the line too early. And so we're going to have to continue to keep the pressure on the enemy. There's no room for complacency on this.
100 civilians were killed after a U.S. bomb hit a building in Mosul in Iraq. Is this the result of this faster tempo? Is this the kind of thing Americans need to get used to as a natural byproduct of this strategy?
Now, this is the incident that we talked about where we had guys come on the program and talked about our own personal history of seeing them use people, limit their ability to move, when somewhere between 100 and 200 people were killed in Mosul. So Secretary Mattis alludes to that right here.
The American people and the American military will never get used to civilian casualties. We will fight against that every way we can possibly bring our intelligence and our tactics to bear. In this case, again, people who had tried to leave that city were not allowed to by ISIS. We are the good guys. We're not the perfect guys, but we are the good guys. And so we're doing what we can. We believe we found residue that was not consistent with our bomb. So we believe that what happened there was that ISIS had stored munitions in a residential location, showing once again the callous disregard that has characterized every operation they have run.
In North Korea, Americans have been used to a certain kind of warfare for the last 16 years in the Middle East. Help people understand what a conflict with North Korea would be like and how it would be different.
A conflict in North Korea, John, would be probably the worst kind of fighting in most people's lifetimes. Why do I say this? The North Korean regime has hundreds of artillery cannons and rocket launchers within range of one of the most densely populated cities on Earth, which is the capital of South Korea. We are working with the international community to deal with this issue. As you're aware, numerous administrations, Republican and Democrat, have tried to deal with this issue in the past, aligned with our allies and other nations. Right now, this regime is a threat to the region, to Japan, to South Korea, and in the event of war, they would bring danger to China and to Russia as well. But the bottom line is, it would be a catastrophic war if this turns into combat, if we're not able to resolve this situation through diplomatic means.
North Korea has been testing missiles. Are they getting any better at their capability?
We always assume that with a testing program, they get better with each test.
You say North Korea is a threat to the region. Is North Korea a threat to the United States?
It is a direct threat to the United States. They have been very clear in their rhetoric. We don't have to wait until they have an intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon on it to say that now it's manifested completely.
What is the line in North Korea that if the regime crosses that line, in your view, the U.S. should take action?
Yeah, I'd prefer not to answer that question, John. The president needs political maneuver room on this issue. We do not draw red lines unless we intend to carry them out. We've made very clear that we're willing to work with China, and we believe China has tried to be helpful in this regard.
Give me a sense, if you can, of the time when you think North Korea would get to a position where they might either have an intercontinental ballistic missile on which they could put a nuclear warhead or where they could get to the point of no return.
We consider it a direct threat even today, the North Korean threat. As far as that specific threat, I don't want to put a timeline on it at this time. What we know, I'd prefer to keep silent about, because we may actually know some things the North Koreans don't even know.
Let me switch to NATO. The president recently met with NATO leaders. He didn't mention the commitment in NATO, the so-called Article 5 commitment, attack on one is an attack on all. Why not?
I think when President Trump chooses to go to NATO personally and stand there alongside the other more than two dozen nations in NATO, that was his statement, not words, actions.
You are a strong believer in NATO. The president seems to need convincing on the power and importance of the NATO alliance. Do you have to convince him of how important NATO is?
We've had good talks about it, John. For example, in my initial job interview with the president right after Thanksgiving in New Jersey, I'd never met the president-elect before at that time, now president, and he brought up his questions about NATO. And my response was that I thought that if we didn't have NATO, that he would want to create it, because it's a defense of our values. It's a defense of democracy. He was very open to that. Obviously, he had to make a decision about whether or not he was going to hire me as the nominate me to be the Secretary of Defense. And although I immediately showed him that my view on that was rather profoundly in support of NATO, he, at that point, nominated me to the Senate. So I would just tell you that he has demonstrated from his statement in front of the House and the Senate, where he said, I strongly support NATO, to his visit to Brussels on his first overseas trip. He's clearly made his statement about where he stands vis-a-vis NATO.
During the previous Obama administration, a senior NATO official said, we need to know that the Americans are with us. Are the Americans with NATO now? Can they be assured of that?
I have met with over half the counterparts I have from the NATO nations. They have no doubt that we are with them. And at this point, it's more how do we work together. There's no sense that they have to argue or discuss or question that commitment.
Are any NATO countries now under either threat or attack as you see it, either not militarily but sometimes cyber?
They are under various forms of attack, John. For example, Turkey has an active insurgency. That's the PKK, the only NATO nation that confronts an active insurgency inside its borders. We have seen the terrorist threat, especially against the southern nations of NATO. But also, as we all saw just a week ago in Manchester, where children were murdered intentionally by ISIS-inspired terrorists, so the terrorist threat is real. From the east, we have Russia, which has declined to engage in a positive, productive manner, and has obviously, through its activities, shattered trust with a number of nations, especially along the eastern periphery. And this, at the same time, democratic processes, elections, the Russians have mucked around inside other people's elections. And so, yes, NATO recognizes the shifting sense of the threat.
The president has encouraged NATO members to pay up. Is that bearing any fruit?
It is. As of this year, we see a second year in a row of increased military spending. Taken together, the non-U.S. members of NATO spend four times as much on military defense than Russia does. So this is no insignificant amount. Furthermore, This is an organization of democratic nations, so every nation rightly gets its own say, but it is one that for the first time went into combat, went to war when the United States was attacked. It was organized, trained, equipped to rebuff the Soviet armies following World War II, and it never had to fire a shot. Probably the most successful military alliance in history. But when the United States was attacked, they all responded, and they were there with us in Afghanistan.
When the president puts pressure on these NATO members to pay up, is there any worry that might backfire, that they might, domestically, it might, they don't want to look like they're bowing to the pressure of the American president?
I would just say that having been a NATO officer under President Bush and President Obama, and then having been back there in Brussels representing the Department of Defense under President Trump, that this is a consistent message that we have given the NATO nations, where President Bush wanted them to pay more for the common defense. They get the best defense in the world, the NATO countries, and we've all got to be willing to deal with it like a bank. If you want to take something out of it, you got to put something into it. President Obama sent the same message to NATO, that they had to pay their fair share. Finally, during President Obama's time, all the nations made a commitment in Wales that they would do that. So what President Trump is doing is consistent with both prior Republican and Democrat administrations. And the bottom line is the nations are spending more on defense now than they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
What do the Russians want?
Beats me. Right now, Russia's future should be wedded to Europe. Why they see NATO as a threat is beyond me. Clearly, NATO is not a threat. It does not have aligned the offensive capability along its eastern border with Russia, or it's no threat to Western Russia or any other part. But right now, Russia is choosing to be a strategic competitor for any number of reasons. But the bottom line is NATO is not a threat, and they know it. They have no doubt about it. These are offensive actions by them when they go in cyber, or they go in with the kind of conduct they've had in Crimea and that sort of thing.
You've said that Russia is trying to break apart NATO. Is the United States going to take any action to deal with Russia as a threat to NATO, either in helping in the Balkans or in any other way?
Right now, we are dealing with Russia, attempting to deal with Russia under President Trump's direction in a diplomatic manner. And Secretary Tillerson, as you know, has met several times with his counterpart, and we are attempting to do that. At the same time, while willing to engage diplomatically, we are going to have to confront Russia when it comes to areas where they attack us, whether it be with cyber or they try to change borders using armed force. And that's admittedly a strategically uncomfortable position, engaging diplomatically, trying to find a way out of this situation, but confronting them where we must. And we are going to continue in this mode, and hopefully soon our diplomats will work their magic and start moving us out of this this quandary we find ourselves in.
Is there anywhere where America will confront Russia militarily?
That I would think not. I would hope not. But we do have, I was just up in Lithuania here about 2 weeks ago, where I saw U.S. soldiers as part of a German-led battle group in Lithuania that is reinforcing the Baltic nations. I will also say that even nations in Northern Europe that are not part of NATO are very, very uncomfortable with Russia's behavior over the last several years. And so this is not a paranoia on the part of the United States or on the part of NATO. This is a reality that Russia has acted in a manner that's very disheartening for all nations that want peace and prosperity in Europe.
When you served under President Obama, you were asked, I believe, by the president, what worries you? And you said three things, Iran, Iran, Iran. Is that still your feeling?
I had a more, let's just say, a narrower portfolio in those days because President Obama had assigned me as the commander of U.S. Central Command. And in the U.S. Central region, what we find is wherever there are challenges, wherever there is chaos, wherever there is violence, whether it be in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, the attempts to unsettle Bahrain. We always find Iran and the IRGC at it, and it's not the Iranian people. We are convinced it's a regime that is conducting itself in order to stay in power in Tehran as a revolutionary regime, not as a proper nation state. They are not looking out for the best interests of their own people. And so you've got this revolutionary cause that causes them to then go around creating mischief everywhere, to include trying to murder an Arab ambassador fewer than 2 miles from the White House a couple years ago. And I've seen the intelligence. This was not a rogue agent. This was an operation approved at the highest levels. And so, ambassadors are men and women of peace. And for someone to try to murder an ambassador in Washington, D.C., you can understand why President Obama was committed to stopping the nuclear program.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
You mentioned to the New Yorker you were...
How awesome is that? And he doesn't say it with any bravado or anything like that. He's not waiting for a rim shot. It's just boom.
Worried about the lack of political unity in America.
Well, I'm at West Point is where we're talking together, John. And you look at these young people who graduated today, over 900 of them, from all walks of life. Every religion probably in America is represented. Every state is represented. And these people come together with an enthusiasm for protecting this experiment in democracy that we call America. And it takes people, I believe, with a fundamental respect for one another, with a fundamental friendliness toward one another, that I worry is starting to slip away in our country. We still have it in the military. It's a diverse force. It's a force that can work together under the worst conditions. And I just hope we can find our way back to engaging with one another, arguing strongly with one another, and then going down and having a root beer together or something, and having a good laugh about it as we work together for the best interests of the next generation of Americans who are going to inherit this country.
More than 40 years ago, you enlisted, and then today you speak as the Secretary of Defense at West Point. What's that like, going from those two different ends in the span of your career?
It's humbling, to tell you the truth, because as you go up, you realize how little, other than exercise good judgment, you really do, that it falls on the shoulders of very, very young people to carry this out inside the Department of Defense. I was an infantry officer in the Marines, and the infantry are named because they're young soldiers, how you got their name. They're very young. And so it's really a humbling sense of just how great our younger generation is, how selfless it is, and what they are willing to commit, basically signing a blank check payable to the American people with their very lives to protect it. And that's really what I've come away from this job with, is a deeper sense of just being humbled by the commitment of others.
After Central Command, there was a report that you drove back home to your home state of Washington and stopped by the families of some of the people who'd paid that ultimate price. Can you tell us a little bit about that trip?
I'd prefer not.
Let me ask you about the Paris Climate Accords. The president is going to make a decision on those. Tell me about the national security role of climate change.
We've obviously got a discussion going on about our policy in this regard. And I was sitting in on some of the discussions in Brussels, by the way, where climate change came up. And the president was open. He was curious about why others were in the position they were in, his counterparts in other nations. And I'm quite certain the president is wide open on this issue as he takes in the pros and cons of that accord. And frankly, it's not inside my portfolio, that aspect. Obviously, we deal with the aspects of a warming climate in the Department of Defense. And to us, that's just another one of the many factors we deal with, which we call the physical environment.
You like to read books on history to prepare for moments. What book or history right now prepares you for this moment? Is there one?
It would be hard to pick out one book as far as a recent book that has struck me as helping to explain America, and I think it's a wonderful subject to study, it'd be Earning the Rockies by Kaplan. It's a wonderful new book that's out, and it's helped open my eyes to what our geographic situation is and how that has influenced us over many, many years.
Secretary Mattis, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You know, what they edited, I don't know how long it was on the actual program itself, but it couldn't have been more than 15 minutes, I don't think. And his comments on Iran specifically are awesome. Yeah, are absolutely awesome. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, when you look at these interviews, and that's one of the reasons I like the C-SPAN stuff, is they do long-format interviews. If you just got the Reader's Digest version of that, you didn't get the best part of that interview. Yeah, you missed the best part of the interview. So the interview itself runs about 31 minutes, 30 minutes, 29 seconds. And, you know, the part about the Iranian, you know, assassination attempt of a sitting ambassador, you know, in Washington, D.C., yeah, we'll do it in the United States. You know, it's crazy. So, and then, but I think his comments about domestic politics in the United States, that's got to become an issue for the nation. And if it doesn't, we're only going to see more and more of the ridiculous sequestration nonsense that we've seen in the past. Because it's not going, it's not getting better. It's getting worse. And it's not getting worse in a little way. It's getting worse in a big way. And I think, again, what I would tell you is the results of the last election, the rejection of Hillary Clinton, in spite of her years and years of public service, the fact that she was a first lady, a senator, the secretary of state, loses to a big mouth novice, tells you what. And let's just say arguably 35% of the voters are hardcore Democrats. She has to win 16% of the undecided. 16 more percent. Okay, so let's take 30% and put it off limits. Okay, let's just say that's hardcore Republicans and they're not going anywhere. So that leaves 35%. She doesn't even have to win 50% of the undecided to be the president. And the undecided voters in this country said, no, we don't want that. We want change. We're tired of Washington, D.C. We're tired of this business-as-usual nonsense, and we'll take a chance on him with everything that was said about him in the election. We'll take a chance on him with everything that came out about him, to include most damning were his own words. Things he said about women, right? The things that come out of the guy's mouth on the campaign trail. And an utter novice to government. That's how fed up the American people are. And people that try to break it down into Republican, Democrat, I think, are missing the point. And so I think Secretary Mattis's words, in fact, I love the fact that he said that in the interview. That we need to be able to get back to this. We need to be able to fight and then do the business of the people. Because that's not the way it's going, and that's not the way it's trending. So I'll tell you, I can't get enough of, and I hope the country can't get enough of guys like him, guys like Kelly. You'll hear John Kelly's interview coming up next, and it's awesome. And what I really love is when reporters try to take them places, and they just won't go there. They're experienced, honest, professional people that have been devoted to the nation, and we just don't see them on television often enough. We simply don't. And so Secretary Mattis, you know, the host, John Dickerson, he wants to talk about supposedly, and there's no doubt in my mind that Secretary Mattis did it if he drove across the country. I'll tell you a quick story about him. General Nicholson, Larry Nicholson, Larry Nicholson, I think he's 2MEP now. I think he's Lieutenant General now. And he was a P1 colonel. He's a friend of mine. So, yeah, Lieutenant General Larry Nicholson. He's a 3-star. He's a P1 colonel. He's the commanding officer. He had been wounded when he went down and took over the 1st Marine Regiment. And so, anyway, let me just real quick on that to tell you Nicholson's comment, which is a Mattis story. So I meet Nicholson. He's actually, I think, attached to NATO in 2004. He comes down for about a week to hang out in Al Anbar because he's going to come back and be the G3. So he's come in, and so because he's hanging out with Dunford, who's the chief of staff, he gets kicked to me. Hey, Mac, make sure Larry's got what he needs. Yes, sir. Nicholson grabs a baseball off my desk and starts bouncing it off the marble floor, and I had to put an end to that. I'm like, hey, Colonel, I don't know where you're from, but who taught you to do that with a baseball? Don't do that. It's not how we do it. And so Nicholson and I become friends, to say the least. He goes down to take over 1st Marine Regiment. I want to say it was October, late September, early October of 2004. And General Tulin's going, or Colonel Tulin's going home, later General Tulin, and to take over EWS or something like that. And Nicholson goes down there. They do the change of command in the morning. In the afternoon, Nicholson has a staff meeting at 1600, 4 o'clock, tells his commo, hey, could you send somebody by? My computer's acting up, not doing, something won't connect or do something right. Kevin Shea says yes. And then, you know, the meeting goes on, it ends. Nicholson's in his office. Shea walks by the door, stops and says, hey, sir, I've got time. Nicholson says, hey, it's not significant. You know, you can just send somebody down when you got a chance. And Shea says, no, I've got time. So Nicholson stands up, Shea sits down, and there was a window behind where Shea was. It was boarded up with plywood, and in less than maybe 2 minutes, Nicholson bends down and says, hey, Kevin, what's this wire down here? And that bending down saves his life. A 120-millimeter rocket comes through the window, kills Major Shea, whose daughter just graduated from the Naval Academy, by the way. And so Nicholson's badly wounded, so he's medevac. That's September. I leave Iraq in December. I'm probably back at Camp Pendleton in the middle of December, and I'm up at the Division CP, the White House as it's known, and who comes around the corner but Larry Nicholson? And I looked. I was like, oh, my God. So a few of us went out and had a beer that night, and he was, he got told that, you know, as soon as he got better, they would see if they could get him his command. So he's given 5th Marine Regiment. He calls me and says, I'm going to Fallujah. I want you to come with me. So I go with the 5th Marine Regiment to Fallujah in 2005. So one night, I'm in his office talking to him, and I don't know how it came up, but he was talking about being wounded, General Mattis, and who was then the MEF commander. He said he's asleep in his hospital bed at Bethesda. And he kind of wakes up a little bit, but he senses that somebody's in the room, and with that, he opens his eyes. And here's General Mattis sitting there reading a book. And he He looks over and he says, I thought my eyes were tricking me. He said, and he looked at me and he said, it's okay. You can go back to sleep. I'm just going to be here with you for a while. And he said, you know, I was really tired and groggy. I tried to, you know, wake up and talk to him. And he said, I don't know how long we spoke for. And then the nurse later told him that, yeah, he was here for about 4 hours, you know, just reading. And so when John Dickerson asked Mattis about driving cross country, you know, that's the stuff he does. He's not casually committed to this endeavor of democracy. He's all in. And I love the way that General Mattis just say, I'd prefer not to. And they go on. The nation needs more people like Joe Dunford, John Kelly, James Mattis, H.R. McMaster. They believe in the country. They put the country first always and not their party. That nonsense is killing the nation. More of All Marine Radio on a Tuesday coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts with 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.